Ms. Goldblum.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Marcy Goldblum on behalf of the plaintiff, Robert Nicholson, in this case. Mr. Nicholson, who was 48 at the time that he filed his application, was 50, going on 51 at the time that he appeared in front of the administrative law judge. His past work was as a hog herder and as a laborer. I'd like to cover several points this morning. First one being that the administrative law judge rendered his decision on what we believe is less than a full and fair record. This gentleman was represented, and defendant makes much of the fact that when a claimant is represented, the administrative law judge shouldn't have to develop the record. But that's not quite what the regulations say.
But by the same token, isn't it fair if somebody's represented and the administrative law judge turns to the person and says, you know, is there anything else? You know, I'm going to leave it open. It makes sense to me to have a system in which the administrative law judge can take counsel's word for it, you know.
Well, you know, in most circumstances, yes, that's true. But what happened here is that the attorney submitted what little he could get. He got this report from Dr. Ackerman, who my sense is that this was a doctor who would call in prescriptions and see this gentleman every so often.
But why didn't the attorney just say, let's get an X-ray or let's do, you know.
In the best of all possible worlds, he would have. But I don't think that relieves the judge from his responsibility. And let me tell you why. The judge, after the hearing, the judge is going over this material, and he decides he's not going to give any weight to Dr. Ackerman's report. So then what is he left with?
Well, he's left in part with Mr. Nicholson's testimony.
That's true. And let's talk about his testimony. The administrative law judge finds that he's not credible, but he doesn't follow Social Security ruling 96-7P. He never talks about Mr. Nicholson's daily activities, which is the first thing that Social Security ruling 96-7P says he has to discuss. And when you look at his activities, he says he doesn't clean, he doesn't make the beds or do laundry because it hurts for him to stand too long. It hurts too much to do yard work, to do household repairs, to wash his car. He likes to cook, but he can't stand up long enough to cook. Well, what's interesting about that is at his age, particularly once he hit age 50, if he was unable to do the standing and walking required of light work, then at the sedentary level, the GRID rules, the medical vocational guidelines direct a finding that he's disabled. The administrative law judge never says, this is what's inconsistent, or this is why I don't credit his testimony about difficulty standing and walking. And what's problematic is the judge says, well, the medical record doesn't support it.
But I thought he was concerned in that there's some discussion with Mr. Nicholson about, you know, why or when does he see doctors or how often has he been. And Mr. Nicholson says things like, well, I go when I think I need to. He doesn't say, actually, you know, I don't have enough money to see doctors or things that we know exist out there in the world. But he's not saying that.
No, he did, though, in an early report to Social Security, he did say, I don't have a medical card.
But then when he's asked at this hearing, he seems to indicate that he only goes to the doctor when he thinks he needs to, and it's not that often.
Well, there's something interesting about that. He also testifies that at some point prior to the hearing, I think he says either 8 or 10 months, he started taking tramadol, which it means that sometime 8-10 months prior to the hearing, he was prescribed an opiate pain medication. So what that indicates is here's this gentleman who's now 50 years old. There's no real medical evidence in the record for 2.5 years, but he's testifying that he's now taking tramadol.
Who prescribed that?
Dr. Ackerman.
Dr. Ackerman, yeah.
So there's an indication that, not surprisingly, that his condition has worsened. And when that puts us in a situation of here's the judge who's making a decision on a record that doesn't have anything in it. Now, we're not saying specifically what the judge had to do in that circumstance. He could have called Nicholson's attorney and said, you know, I'm inclined not to give any weight to Dr. Ackerman's assessment because I don't think it's supported. Can you submit anything else, or is there anything you want me to do? Or he could have maybe sent an interrogatory to a medical expert on their panel and said, you know, what do you think here in terms of, you know, there's an indication that there's been some worsening of the situation. But basically what he did is he said, okay, I'm not going to give any weight to Dr. Ackerman's report. And then based on what I got here, which isn't very much, I'm going to find that this gentleman who has a progressive arthritic disorder.
How's the evidence on the progressivity of this? Is this just something we're all supposed to know, or is this something that's on the record?
I think Dr. Ackerman, even if you're not going to accept his assessment in terms of the limitations, he does talk about degenerative joint disease. He actually mentions sciatica, but degenerative joint disease, particularly in someone who has this history that goes back to having had two surgeries in, I think, 1984 and 1987.
Quite a long time ago, and quite a long time before he
And he worked after that, right. And I think it's very frequently we see that people who had these back surgeries 15, 20 years ago, they tend to develop, if not post-surgical arthritis, it advances with age. But that was not developed, and that was compounded by the fact that the credibility assessment doesn't touch on any of these factors. The judge never says, you know, his daily activities might be consistent, or he doesn't say they're inconsistent with anything, and he never mentions the fact that he's taking narcotic pain medication in terms of how that affects credibility. And finally, though, and I think what's also important about this case is that the judge didn't follow Social Security ruling 004P. Now, again, defendant's contention is that the ALJ, before the vocational expert testified, said, now let me know if your testimony is going to conflicts with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. Here's why we think that that's inappropriate. Under Social Security ruling 004P, it is specifically the administrative law judge's responsibility to verify that the vocational expert's testimony is consistent with the DOT.
You raise this point and you cite a district court case on this, but I don't see what's wrong with the Social Security judge saying, you know, while you go along, if you are in some way seeing this differently from the DOT, please alert me. What? Isn't that fine?
No, it's not, and I'll tell you why. The way that the hearings work, the vocational expert is asked a series of hypothetical questions. Mm-hmm. Very often they kind of get caught up in them. It's ultimately the administrative law judge's responsibility, and by asking the vocational expert at the beginning, saying, hey, let me know if anything conflicts, he's putting the onus of verification on the vocational expert to remember to do that when it's his burden. And the thing is, what we're asking, and I think the Harris Court, which is the Indiana District Court decision, I thought their rationale was laid out very succinctly. And this isn't a case where we're asking that the administrative law judge take on an onerous responsibility. It's really the same question.
Your whole case depends on the administrative law judge having said it. I suppose you don't forbid him from saying it at the beginning. You just want him to say it again at the end.
But absolutely.
That does.
Absolutely. Well, here's the thing. I think what it does is it verifies that the vocational expert may have kept track of whether or not the testimony was consistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. I mean, they're having to make, in some respects, they're having to kind of make on-the-spot guesstimates or opinions, and you know, hypotheticals that include often various limitations. And I think what they're really concerned with at that point is going through their materials, their expertise. Are there jobs that they think fit that criteria? And I think that for the ALJ to also assume that they're going to remember to talk about the DOT as well, even if they've been given the instruction in the beginning, I think that it's putting too much responsibility on the vocational expert, and taking it away from the administrative law judge whose ultimate responsibility it is under the Social Security ruling. And thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Goldblum. Ms. Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Siegel, and I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this case. I'd like to touch on a few of the issues that Ms. Goldblum has raised before the court. First of all, with regard to the duty to develop the record, I think the court has a good understanding that the ALJ is entitled to rely on the fact that the claimant has an attorney, and they can assume that he has presented his best case for disability benefits when he has an attorney to represent him and to help him to acquire evidence and to present that evidence to the agency.
You know what worries me about this case, Ms. Siegel, really kind of in global view, is that it really looks like a very cursory spin through the evidence on the ALJ's part, whether it's the fact that so much of this medical evidence is 2.5 years old, the fact that there are aspects of the record that are incontestable, such as a medication that he's taking, whatever else you may think of Dr. Ackerman. Now, maybe you think he's just a pill pusher, you know, but the ALJ hasn't given us much of a window into his thinking. Why is this really old medical evidence something worth paying attention to?
Well, Your Honor, in his decision, he actually does talk about his reasoning about how he has considered the record, and he does contrast what the claimant says about what he can do on page 15. He goes into very specific discussions about what the claimant's activities are and what he claims that he's able to do. And then he does go into very specific findings with regard to what is in the record. He goes into the consultative examination that was obtained by the agency.
Right, but what I'm worried about is why is a 2.5-year-old medical examination, I don't see his thinking about why for this particular condition 2.5 years ago equals today. Why don't you get a new referral from an agency physician, you know, a panel person? It doesn't have to be Dr. Ackerman. I understand that he might have no confidence in what Dr. Ackerman's saying, but I'm very worried. Some conditions, it seems to me, would tend to be stable, and other conditions would tend to be progressive, and it's not up to either an ALJ or a judge to make that distinction. It's a trained medical expert.
And because the claimant was represented by counsel, he could have had those requested from the ALJ. And in fact, the ALJ did give the claimant's attorney an opportunity to submit anything he wanted to. He got 2 months before the hearing, he actually did submit Dr. Ackerman's report and summarize what the evidence was. And he asked the attorney at the beginning of the hearing, at page 203 of the transcript, very clearly, do you have anything else to add to your claimant's case? And he said, no, you can close the record. I'm paraphrasing it, but that's essentially what the exchange was.
So that means you really are arguing for the rule that Ms. Goldblum is attacking, which is that when somebody's represented, there's no independent duty on the ALJ's part to develop the record, that the Supreme Court's discussion about the investigative role of the ALJ simply does not apply if there's counsel.
I would not say he doesn't have any duty to develop. The agency developed the record to a great extent before in the initial reconsideration stage.
How do you say to a great extent?
We did ask for all the doctors' names, and he submitted the names. We submitted the request to his doctors. The doctor said, we don't have anything for this period in question, because, as you know, this period in question is 2001 through the date last insured, which is 2006.
Yeah.
So it's a limited period of time that we're talking about. When they asked for the records from his doctors, what they came up with essentially was 3 reports from emergency rooms that he had visited, but no treatment records from his doctors. And yet, you know, we did try to get evidence from doctors. It simply wasn't there.
So why doesn't that trigger the need for the ALJ to say, this is a paradigmatic case for sending somebody out for a consultative exam.
He was sent out for a consultative exam in 2004.
In 2.5 years before the hearing. That's what worries me.
Well, there was a lag between the time that he requested the hearing and the time that he actually went to the hearing. So, but
I mean,
during
if you're
that
sending
time,
your kid off to camp, they wouldn't take a 2.5-year-old medical examination. I can't believe something this important can hinge on that.
But the claimant never indicated that there was anything out there that the ALJ should know about.
Why
and
would the
be
claimant
rely
be
on
the
those
person
statements?
To know whether a disease is progressive or not? Mr. Nicholson isn't a highly educated person.
He's claiming that he was completely disabled by his back pain, and yet there really isn't any indication that it's gotten worse. I mean, he's saying the same things that in 2004 that he's saying at the hearing in his reports about not being able to walk and things, and yet the record that was developed at that time shows that he actually does have quite a few abilities. So and the extent that Dr. Ackerman's report was. He was allowed to submit a report from his doctor, and in that report, the doctor was asked, "What are the medical findings that support these restrictions?" And the doctor points to something that happened 15 years ago. He doesn't point to new findings. He doesn't point to MRI scans or even a need for an MRI scan. He doesn't question that this.
No, I understand what you're saying, but I guess what I'm worried about is equating Mr. Nicholson's self-reporting with the idea, let's just take disc disease. If you have a degenerative disc disease, you might feel bad in 2004 and you might still feel bad in 2007, but a trained physician could see that the disc has degenerated since
But the reason a claimant has an attorney to act as his advocate at the hearing is so that he will present his best case, and he will collect evidence, and he will ask the ALJ to leave the record open and to ask for a medical consult. He never asked for another medical consult to update the record.
That just takes me back. So you really don't think that there's any duty on the ALJ's part if there's a lawyer?
He can accept that the best case was presented. That's our position.
Okay.
I'd like to briefly discuss the 004P issue. Here we have an ALJ who absolutely accomplished the goals of the Social Security ruling, which is to identify any conflicts between the vocational expert's testimony and the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. He did this by stating very specifically at the very beginning of the hypothetical question to the vocational expert, he says, as always, point out if there are any conflicts with the DOT or any other labor-relevant materials. And then he goes directly into a rather short hypothetical question, and within a few seconds, the vocational expert starts to testify. And there's no indication at all in the hearing that there are any conflicts. So there are no apparent conflicts raised. The claimant, even before this court, does not claim that the ALJ should have been aware of any apparent conflicts. And because of that, the goals of 004P have been met, and under Overman, this court should affirm the commissioner's decision. The only way that we can even get to the conflicts that the claimant points out is if the court decides that somehow that inquiry at the beginning of the vocational expert testimony did not clearly meet the goals of the Social Security ruling. And even if one did find that there wasn't a sufficient inquiry, the jobs that were identified, each one of them on their own were significant enough in numbers that they would each be a significant number of jobs under the Liskovitz decision. Each job had a lot more than 1,000 jobs that were identified for that. And the cafeteria worker in particular is a light job, it's unskilled, and it doesn't require anything that would conflict with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. And that alone, you could affirm the decision of the commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Siegel. Did Ms. Goldblum have any time left? You did not. You may have a minute, Ms. Goldblum, if you need that.
Just two things. We fervently believe that the administrative law judge has an independent duty to develop the record, and that is a statutory, regulatory duty that has not been changed.
What's the sweep of that responsibility? I mean, how would you frame if you were to draft an opinion that included that language?
Here's the difficult part. I don't know that we can have a bright line. I don't think that you can necessarily say in all cases where the evidence is this dated, there must be development. Because, again, there are cases where the impairment is going to be isn't going to be developmental. I think I'm hesitant to say a common sense approach because that is so.
Yeah, what concerns me, and I'm sympathetic to your suggestion, but will we have to weigh each case, the assessment of the quality of counsel, and how experienced the vocational expert is in testifying?
I suppose one thing is that there could be an artificial line saying that if all the evidence in a case is more than 24 or 30 months old, then there must be some development made.
So the older the case, you're suggesting a more searching inquiry by the ALJ.
Sure, and it can be in conjunction. If there's an attorney, it can certainly be in conjunction with the attorney. I'm not putting all of the onus on the administrative law judge. And finally, the jobs that were noted, there were problems with every single one of them. The first three were heavy or medium. The second two, fast food worker and cafeteria attendant, had reading levels above what Mr. Nicholson was capable of doing. And although some of the jobs he did in the past may have had DOTs noting higher reading levels, I would submit that he did not do those jobs in that fashion, which again brings us to the fact that there needed to be additional and more far-reaching vocational testimony. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Goble, and thank you, Ms. Siegel. The case is taken under advisement.